The term world music is about as big a musical category as you can come up with, but the blend of cultures that we put that label to is actually, of course, a confluence, one that accelerated over the past 100 years thanks to recordings. And we're going to be sampling some, in fact, quite a lot of the first recordings to establish world music at the onset of the modern era. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. My guest is Ron Rodano, professor of musicology and ethnomusicology at the UW-Madison. Welcome to University of the Air.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Have lots of music to listen to, so we're going to get to it pretty quickly. But you're starting with Paul Simon. Interesting departure point.
Yeah, well, Simon is often seen as the kind of starting point for the emergence of Afrobeat, world pop, global pop. It goes by a number of names. And this beat in world beat is often seen as referencing U.S. black music. So it's interesting from the get-go that Simon turns to South Africa, to Soweto, as a point of inspiration for his album Graceland, when in fact what's driving his interest in the first place, I would argue, is already the presence of U.S. black music in the legacy of American popular music, a music that actually reaches worldwide at the onset of the 20th century. So it's as if he's going to Africa in order to find his way back home. And so there is this sense of a kind of a problematic sense of invisibility or of something that's unheard, which is the presence of blackness, musical blackness, which is really what drives my interest in a project right now that I'm working on musical value.
So in a song like I Know What I Know, he's getting this inspiration from South Africa, but actually from black American music?
Well, in his album notes, he acknowledges that when he first heard Mbakwanga, which is the genre of South African music that drew his attention, that it sounded a whole lot like early rock and roll.
Uh-huh, sure, yes. We've noticed that, yeah.
And there was already then a sense of familiarity from which he could build. And so he is extrapolating, I would argue, from the black presence in U.S. music and going back home to kind of come back home to the United States.
She thought I was all right in a sort of a limited way for an off night. She said, don't I know you from the cinematographer's party? I said, who am I to blow against the wind?
I know, I know, I said what I've said.
Paul Simon really did get into that, not just, of course, African, but also South American music, too, didn't he?
Yeah, he had quite a wide reach in his interests. And that kind of reach is actually reflective in some of what we're going to be listening to today.
You know, looking at your playlist here, one of the last things I would have expected to see second is John Philip Sousa.
The March King.
Uh-huh, yeah. Sure. Yeah. Okay. How does he tie into world music origins?
One might argue that Sousa, in fact, was the first global pop musician.
Really?
He was hugely popular in Europe, but his sheet music was circulating widely. He toured to Europe at the turn of the 20th century. His presence was well known. He was also performing not only strictly marches, but a variety of music, including what was broadly construed as ragtime, which is arguably the first African-American popular genre.
Yeah.
It's interesting, too, because he was such a foe of recording. And, and at the same time, he was a recording artist.
Well, this whole relationship with ragtime is kind of interesting because Sousa marches, and before them, to some extent, German marches, influence ragtime.
By all means.
And then ragtime comes around and influences, to some extent, Sousa.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. And ragtime has an enormous influence across the American popular music by the early part of the 20th century.
So at a Georgia camp meeting, which is a pretty kind of out-of-the-way Sousa track, we find some of this influence.
Yes, and just to mess it up a little bit more, it's written by a white Philadelphia composer named Kerry Mills in the genre of ragtime, which becomes claimed in large part as American popular music. And we see at this point a continuing contest between ownership of black music. Is it American? Is it black? Is it both? And this will be part of this story.
At a Georgia camp meeting. Circa 1902 recording there on Victor Records of the Sousa Band with at a Georgia camp meeting, which makes your point, Ron, that there, you can see the black influence in that you can't see, of course, in much of Sousa.
Mm-hmm. That's true, yeah.
So what about James Reese Europe?
Yes.
And his 369th U.S. Infantry Hellfighters Band. That's another one that you don't hear too much from, to say the least.
Not too often.
But with a tune called Jazzola, we would expect some influence.
Yeah, yeah. Europe was a really fascinating figure. He was a big star in New York in the early 1910s in the dance scene. And then he is serving during World War I in France as a band leader, but also as a warrior, as a member of this infantry. And he becomes a very popular figure after the war in Paris as a band leader. And his music becomes so well known in Paris that it draws the attention of Pathé label and their recording in New York, their initiative in New York. Decides to record him and to bring together this ensemble and others for yet another series of recordings. So the Hellfighters Band recordings from the latter part of the 19-teens, from 1919, I believe, is a demonstration of a sound that he was introducing in Paris at the time of an African-American orchestral music, which was commonly known as syncopated music.
Sure.
And it has a certain inflection of African-American practices in it. But at the same time, Europe, as Frederick Douglass, we might say, becomes a kind of representative African-American representing jazz. And he's the go-to guy for explaining this new phenomenon that is circulating just over the past couple of years worldwide, largely through recordings.
And the French picked it up probably more than anyone else in Europe.
Yeah, well, actually, he was based in Paris for a time, and so he was well received. But African American music was recognized in London and in Berlin and elsewhere by this time as well.
This is Jazzola.
¶¶ come jazzers, gather round. Jazz lovers from every town. I've got something that I'd like to introduce you to. It's got a funny name that's going to win its fame. With your kind attention, I will mention its many charms to you. They call it jazzola. Nobody knows its origination. Jazzola. It's just a dance full of syncopation. And if you crave a new sensation, come with me, you will see strange sights from the land of harmony. Old folks and young folks cry for jazzola. It's like a tonic taken with me. How could you feel? My old friend had heard the news. Pop his cane for dancing too. The whole world's crazy of the jazzola. Just take your sweetie sweet out for a jazzy treat, and she loves you like she never did before. Oh, what more? No need of fine wine. You have a much better time. Get those jazz musicians, joy physicians, to play it o'er and o'er. Just ask for jazzola. Nobody knows its origination. Jazzola. It's just a dance full of syncopation. And if you crave a new sensation, come with me, you will see strange sights from the land of harmony. Old folks and young folks cry for jazzola. It's like a tonic taken with each meal. How grand you feel. Old men who are out of step, find jazzola, give them pep. The whole world's going crazy about jazzola. Jazzola. Nobody knows its origination. Jazzola. It's just a dance full of syncopation. And if you crave a new sensation, come with me.
Noble Sissel did the vocals there in Jazzola. He was a cohort of UB Blake's.
He was indeed, yeah, and they were they collaborated for the work Shuffle Along, which is going to be recreated on Broadway soon, as I hear.
Well, how exotic can we get, Ron? I see you have something recorded in Calcutta. Does that mean it's going to have an Indian cast to it, or is it something that sounds like it's from somewhere else, just happened to be recorded in Calcutta?
Yeah, I don't know that you would recognize any South Asian indication in it, but just as jazzola is making not only Americans aware of jazz as international, there's a growing international awareness of jazz as something American and as a practice that is inflected with something known as blackness increasingly. This recording that we'll be giving a listen to is led by a Canadian musician named Jimmy Lakim. It's recorded in Calcutta on Harlequin, not on Harlequin, actually on HMV. It was re-released on Harlequin in 1925. The title, Soho Blues, is a reference to London's Soho. And
sure.
It's a kind of nostalgia piece in a way for European and American business people, and as well as government officials, those who are in metropolitan South Asia and East Asia. And this ensemble, though, is interesting in that it's an international ensemble of musicians from South Africa, England, Canada, U.S., also a Filipino trombonist named Nick Ampere, who we're going to hear more about in a little bit. But at the same time, there's a kind of deracination of jazz taking place here, of jazz as something that is quintessentially American, but the presence of blackness is obscured to a great extent. This is also an expression of Paul Whiteman's influence. You'll hear in this recording the king of jazz, as he was known in the
20s. Or the king of the jazz age, more accurately,
because
most of what Whiteman would play would not really strike you as being jazz.
Not anymore, no.
and Whiteman, of course, a white band leader. Kind of offhand, was his band all white, Whiteman's band?
Yes, it was. Mm-hmm. It was a white band. He had in the late 20s a trumpeter named Bix Beiderbecke, who was quite something.
Yes, he was indeed. Made it big on his own. Mm-hmm. Well, so this, as you say, Ron, is an international effort here, international ensemble playing the Soho Blues, recorded in Calcutta. Gong there being very much a staple of music of the 20s. You know, even Gershwin uses it at the end of some of his pieces from that time.
A little Orientalism there.
Yes, well, appropriate here since this thing was recorded in Calcutta.
That's right.
The Soho Blues, and that was a multinational orchestra recording in Calcutta, 1925. We're going to look further at world music recording at the onset of the modern era when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Ron Rodano, and we're looking at world music recording at the onset of the modern era. We're getting into some really interesting exotica here, a lot of it having to do with just, as we'll find out, remakes of tunes that came from America, but you might say the racial origins of these things are kind of circular, going back and forth between America Africa, Asia, and even Europe and America. What about the home ground there, Ron? What about Wisconsin? What was happening if we look at the 19-teens and 20s?
We will see bands that are similar to Jimmy LaKeem's and indeed similar to Whiteman's that were expressive of this new broadly construed sense of jazz, which was really a popular dance music performed by orchestras, including bands such as the Divine's Wisconsin Rooftop Theater Orchestra, which was popular in Milwaukee's, and I recently dug up a recording of their performance of Tiger Rag. This is something that listeners could easily find on YouTube as well.
Maybe the most famous recording of the Tiger Rag, other than maybe, I don't know, maybe Spike Jones did one, but the Mills Brothers.
Yes, indeed. Actually, and it calls back to an original Dixieland jazz band recording of Tiger Rag from 1918, which circulated very quickly worldwide and introduced the New Orleans, a white version of the New Orleans jazz sound. But the Mills Brothers are one of several groups that recreated it in a 1932 recording, a vocal quartet that was remarkable in their virtuoso expression as vocalists, but also as vocalists imitating instruments as well.
Well, that's true, and we'll hear some of that in a second. But also, would you call it scat singing that we're hearing as we get into this Tiger Rag?
Not precisely. Mm-hmm. The scat is the use of a kind of nonsense syllable in an improvisatory way, whereas this is a recreation of instrumental practices that is brought into an overall vocal approach.
So say what you think as we hear this from 1932?
That's right.
The Tiger Rag, the Mills Brothers. Well, they couldn't have gone on much longer with that. That's pretty intense stuff there. But it's interesting, Ron, that you have, as you say, voices imitating instruments, especially sort of the mute effect, whereas those instruments in the first place were imitating the human voice. So again, the circles around.
That's right. Yeah, there's a kind of grand circularity there.
Mm-hmm. Did the Tiger Rag catch on in other countries with imitators?
Yes, this notion of relation and circularity is also taking place with the song itself or the tune itself. And we can hear also Tiger Rag appearing in countless places, in large part because of the recordings that are traveling there. But also what we will hear is in Japan that there is a presence of jazz, that a real jazz scene is emerging by the mid-1920s and taking off, in part by among elites, but it begins to draw increasingly middle classes and lower classes who are performing as well. in this recording that we have lined up, we're going to hear a recording by an orchestra accompanying a singing group led by Nakano Tadaharu performing Tiger Rag in 1935. And Columbia had set up shop in Japan and had its own orchestra, had a musician who was called the Paul Whiteman of Japan who was leading the orchestra. He had left Columbia by this time. But nonetheless, we hear a remarkably virtuosic expression that is clearly, in this case, copying or referencing the Mills Brothers recording, but doing their own
kind of localizing
their own performance as well. Yeah, mm-hmm. There's to an extent certainly because of the language, but it's distinctive in its own right.
Japan in those years, 20s, 30s, fascinating place. I mean, baseball, very popular there, and American jazz, too, as we found out from that version of the Tiger Rag. And it was the Columbia Jazz Band and Japanese performers in the band, Ron?
Well, it was a singing group that was performing alongside the studio orchestra.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I don't think we're in Kansas anymore.
Yeah.
Then you have another one here that is international, to say the least. It composed in Manila but recorded in Germany. And Germany was a place where, as we saw even into World War II, the pop idiom, jazz idiom, was very adroitly captured by, no pun intended, by German musicians.
Yes, indeed. Well, German bands were performing versions of African-American music, American popular music, way back into the early part of the 20th century, as well as tango, too. Tango was very popular across Europe, including in Berlin. But during the Nazi regime, there were bands performing jazz as a kind of propaganda tool.
Sure, yeah, Charlie's Orchestra.
Yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Very convincing until you heard the lyrics kick in, or the stated lyrics, you might say. Mm-hmm. So this that we find, if we go to a piece that was composed in 1924 and in Manila, and then made its way to Germany. It's Manila's Jazz Scandal. That's a great title. What do we find in that?
Well, it's expressive of the very fact of jazz as something scandalous increasingly across East Asia and into Southeast Asia. It's important to remember that the Philippines was an occupied territory of the United States. And at this point, there are a number of Filipino musicians who are performing in jazz orchestras across East Asia. I should note that much of my knowledge of this comes from a graduate student here, Fritz Schenker, who's writing a dissertation on the colonial era of jazz in East Asia in the 1920s. And he is actually the person who secured this recording by Benito Trapaga, or composed by Trapaga. And Fritz secured this from Trapaga's family. It's a recording, as you mentioned, recorded in 1927. I don't know why in Berlin or how it showed up that way, but it's telling of this kind of scandal attached to jazz as a marker of the illicit, not only of blackness, but also of a certain sense of the illicit relating to sexuality, to poverty, and the kinds of cultural practices that often emerge within that.
Which, of course, I guess you call the counterculture in Germany embraced, I mean, from Kurt Weill right on from there.
To be sure.
The three-penny opera and all of that kind of thing. So let's see what it sounds like. This is Manila's Jazz Scandal. Well, I'm not sure if I would have figured out, Ron, if you hadn't told me that that was a German band, but it certainly had precision, didn't it? It was very crisp.
Absolutely, and one never knows to what extent we heard that kind of precision among Filipino musicians or not. We don't really have recordings from that period.
But that's a rare one, you say, of a Filipino piece, Manila's mm-hmm. Jazz Scandal, but recorded in Germany.
Yeah, and it's an indication of a kind of new, one might even think of it as a kind of indigenous voicing of jazz among Filipino composers as well as musicians. And as I mentioned, the Filipino musicians are proliferating across East and South Asia up into Shanghai and elsewhere.
Well, speaking of Shanghai, that was a city that was, I think, created as a kind of an international port. And mm-hmm. so from the get-go, had a very strong European presence in particular.
Yes, yeah. And it celebrated a certain sense of cosmopolitanism. But along with that came a lot of the issues of racial contest that were problematic in the West and the United States in particular.
So we have Chinese bands, ensembles getting into the jazz scene.
Yes, Chinese ensembles include Chinese personnel, but also a lot of Filipino musicians are performing in Shanghai at this time. But we also see an emergence of a compositional practice of Chinese jazz, which was considered illicit and given the label yellow music. One of the composers of this new genre was Li Jinhui, and we're going to listen to one of his early recordings, which was brought to my attention by Andrew Jones, who's wrote a wonderful book on yellow music, as it's called, teaches out at Berkeley.
So here it is, Express Train.
Thank you.
Add that to your repertory of train music. That was Express Train, recorded in Shanghai, circa 1932. We're going to look further at examples, early examples of world music when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Ron Rodano, and we're looking at what might be called the wellsprings of world music, early examples of international music. And we just heard one from Shanghai called Express Train, and you have one here, Ron, that's no less than Duke Ellington in Chicago, about the same time doing a train piece.
That's right. It's a recording that appears a couple of years later, so... But it's highly unlikely that Ellington was aware of Jin Li.
Or vice versa.
Or vice versa, yes. But even as independent inventions, they're both expressive of a certain sense of the modern and this interest in or celebration of a technology of speed and travel. And it's an enabling technology that enables African Americans to move north as part of the migration practices beginning in the 1910s in earnest. And also in China by the late 19th century, trains are beginning to run as rails across China. And this does speak to a similar kind of modern sensibility in two different places, but they're operating in parallel. The Daybreak Express version is certainly much more virtuosic in a Western sense. So we might have to set that aside, despite it being one of Ellington's masterpieces.
Thank you.
Well, there's a guy who ran a tight train.
Absolutely.
Duke Ellington, 1933, Daybreak Express. I'm trying to think, Tuba Tiger Rag, that was one version of the Tiger Rag that became, you know, obviously popular based on the original song. But so far we haven't, Ron Real actually had a tune that was very popular and then kind of disseminated in different versions. But After You've Gone was a big hit for Gene Austin. I don't know if he was the first to record it, but it was a big seller.
Yeah, it was a tune that was dates back to 1918 and does become a popular hit through the 20s by Leighton and Creamer. And it is, as were a number of tunes, circulating as sheet music and being picked up by musicians in a variety of forms. Recording was also a mode of transmission. But I thought in this instance we could turn to the South and to an example in this this hemisphere of a recording from Argentina, which is a very obscure recording that is remarkable at the same time and demonstrates an ensemble presence of jazz in Buenos Aires. Buenos Aires take on After You've Gone, Ismael Paz and company, a virtuosic bunch and versatile at that. Well, Ron, we started out with Paul Simon as a harbinger, you might say, of world music, and he took some inspiration from South Africa, and you're leading us full circle, looks like. Yeah, I thought it might be a good place to turn toward the end point of a recognition of the presence of American popular music and specifically African-American popular music in South Africa that reaches back into the early part of the 20th century. And the Marabi style of South African music as an early genre of piano music that develops in the slums of Johannesburg in the 1920s is a kind of foundation for much of what we hear in Simon's recording. It follows a very simple chord sequence was popularized by vaudeville troupes and becomes an ongoing source of popularity among South Africans at this point from the 20s into the 30s and 40s.
And so the name of this tune is Tsaba Tsaba K number one?
That's right. And Tsaba Tsaba is actually a genre that supersedes Marabi, but is also based on the same simple chord sequence of a 4-1-5-1 or some version of that.
So here's a taste of that.
Mm-hmm. We can finish with Kipi Mwaketsi and the Marabi Kings. This is a recording from 1958, which gives greater indication of the presence of African-American jazz, a much stronger four-beat figure with a backbeat to it. The tune itself is referencing the cuela, which is a penny whistle music that was popular, comes out of Marabi, and is a genre in its own right in the 1950s, but it's played by a clarinet instead of the penny whistle cuela.
Well, I feel as if I've just had an extensive and very tasty musical smorgasbord, Ron.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it. It was a pleasure.
And thanks for taking us full circuit.
By all means, yeah.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.